Webster's Dictionary defines compliance as the action or fact of complying with a wish or command. This is The Compliance Guide.
The Compliance Guide.
As a healthcare provider or healthcare professional, navigating the muddy waters of compliance can get tricky.
And that's why we're here.
Helping you mitigate risk while increasing your profitability. This is The Compliance Guide. Now, here's your host, Sean Weiss.
All right. Hey, everybody. Welcome to this episode of The Compliance Guy. It is a Monday Coding and Compliance Roundtable. I'm joined by Scott Kraft, Paul Spencer, and Terry Fletcher. Hopefully, Christine Hall's computer issues will work themselves out and she'll be able to join us shortly. And Stephanie Allard is off on assignment somewhere. So we will go with the four Hollywood squares to get us started. I know we have a really good episode lined up for you today. Paul, I want to start with you first, and I want to talk about wound care because there's something interesting going on, and I think we need to kind of explore it further as a panel, and let's see what some of our esteemed colleagues listening to us are.
Okay, well,
are thinking. I just ended with this, the word are. Are what? Are thinking.
I thought you were going to talk about the thickness of insulation there for a moment. But there are some issues going on with wound care. There have really always been some issues going on with wound care, particularly where it occurs and just how often it occurs and who does it. There's always been an issue when you get into wound care that's provided as part of a serial debridement in an office setting, and just exactly who is performing that, and what type of notations are going to be put forward. I've been around long enough to see wound care notes that were basically handwritten templates that had the provider just kind of write in exactly what was looked at, as you get into a serial debridement situation, there was always a temptation to also bill an E&M service at the same time, billing with a 25 modifier, which is verboten, realistically, because unless you've got a new wound of some kind that you're treating and need to assess, if usually when you're dealing with wound care, these are patients who have had a long standing wound, or just upon initial inspection, this is going to take a while. But there are definitely issues when you get into a nursing setting with physicians who are going into that particular setting, because it becomes an issue of who pays you for that service and how you're paid based on consolidated billing and nursing facilities and things of that nature. Sometimes when you're applying wound matrix, you're not going to be paid for that in that kind of setting. So I believe I forwarded you a story that hit the news wires on the healthcare side where, suddenly the different types of wound matrices are not being covered. And there are a number of recoveries that are happening with providers who didn't look into a certain type of wound matrix that they use in order to speed healing, and now are suddenly on the hook for tens, sometimes hundreds of thousands of dollars, because they didn't trust your trusty compliance professionals that you find on this broadcast. They instead trusted the vendors who brought this out and said, "Isn't this great? There's a HCPCS code for it. You can bill it." And we all have learned the hard way that's not the way it works.
Yeah. Go ahead, Terry.
I think what I see with the wound care, and I'm not sure if this is on the same page or not, but people are looking always for edits, or they're looking for, when they get the denials, and they forget to look at MUEs. And that's a really big deal, medically unlikely edits. and understanding how many of one code will be allowed per day. And I've noticed that, you know, people are saying, what can I use to get around this? You know, we had this much in debridements and in the wound care codes, and you have to look at MUEs because some of them you'd be surprised. They only allow two or three or four. And I had one doctor wanted to charge, you know, 47 units of something. I'm like, it's not going to happen. It's almost like I hate to call it a bundling edit, but it is a denial edit where if you go beyond that medically unlikely edit, meaning that it's not that the carrier, the payer and Medicare doesn't believe that you should have more than that, then it's going to get denied. So yeah. I think it stretches beyond that too.
Yeah. And MUEs are ugly because it's, you get some or you get none, depending on how many you bill. And if you bill over that maximum, the whole thing is going to be thrown out, even though you placed at least up to the minimum or up to the maximum rather.
Yeah. You know, wound care has been and continues to be, and most likely will be in the future, one of those specialties that is heavily audited, not just because of things like MUEs and the number of units that are being billed, but I think there's complexity when it comes to the measurement sizes. I think there's a lot of issues with the vendors and the guidance that's being put out there that providers are taking as gospel. But I think more than anything, what's driving it is the fact that a lot of these services are being performed in skilled nursing facilities, and much of them need to be performed in a hospital setting, especially some of these deep debridements and things of that nature. We've seen several cases that have come across our desks just this year alone in 2023, where providers were rendering services in a skilled nursing facility from a wound care perspective that required an inpatient hospital facility to be able to do them. So again, you know, I throw caution to all of you who are hanging out with us for a little while and who spend your Mondays with us, because I'm getting ready to jump on an airplane first thing Wednesday morning, and I am heading off to my seventh federal criminal trial in 2023. And the things that providers are being indicted for, it's fascinating. It's fascinating to me. It's not so fascinating for the individuals who are being indicted. So, Scott, you've been unseasonably quiet on this topic.
You know, sort of ancillarily related, I think one of the bigger challenges I see with wound care, particularly lately, is the volume of unsubstantiated E&M services that come along with it. And you know, the notes are pretty clear that wound care is the service being provided. And, you know, the providers are persistently billing E&M services. And in many cases, there is no basis point at all in the documentation to support that. And in some cases, you know, it's almost like the provider who is specializing in the wound is going to put something in the note about the diabetes or something, right? And the question's going to come up, well, is this, are you managing this, right? Are you the one who's the frontline manager for this? And usually the answer is no. So even beyond just the wound care itself, I think, you know, I've done a number of targeted audits where clients have asked me very specifically, can you look at the wound care codes that run alongside E&M services and make a determination on the appropriateness of both of them? And sometimes it's neither of them, but in many cases, it's E&M services for patients that are being seen once a week, twice a week.
Yeah. Go ahead, Paul. You're on mute.
It really gets tricky when you're dealing with, hello, Christine. It really gets tricky when you're dealing with muscle and bone debridements as well, because you're talking about staged procedures. If you're doing it in over a period of days. And sometimes when you're dealing with the muscle and bone debridements, depending on just how deep that wound is and the amount of damage that that patient has absorbed by the time they get to the wound care physician, it's going to take a few days to get to it. But as I said at the beginning, unless you have a new wound that needs full assessment and has begun treatment at a completely different site from where you have treated that patient in the past, you are only billing the debridement code. It's, you know, that E&M service is for something that is significant and separately identifiable as defined by modifier 25 for the 25th hit year in a row, as I explained that.
Yeah. I think, and again, I think we're going to continue seeing, you know, these audits of these high RVU, high risk services. And I, again, you know, Terry and I talk about this often on the hashtag Terry Tuesdays. Scott, Paul, you and I talk about this all the time in our daily work with Stephanie and Christine's on a lot of the emails as well. You know, if you are going to create these detectable patterns of behavior in your billing, you better have solid policies to be able to defend the arguments that you come forward with when you say Medicare's policy is ambiguous or it's vague or it's lacking specificity and we had to interpret it further. I know Terry sent me a topic for tomorrow that we're going to be talking about pretty extensively on the G2211, which is the add-on for the E&M. We're not going to get into it today because she and I, I'm sure we're going to have a lot of fun talking about that tomorrow. But,
Sean, I wanted to say, you know, you make a great point of having those internal policies, but I work with a lot of organizations that small organizations, you know, less than 15 providers in a group where they say, we didn't know we could do a policy. And I think it's important, once again, to remind people that that's the normal process of your compliance program. When you have your monthly meetings or your quarterly meetings that you're asking what policies need to be put in place, what services are we doing, what did our audit look like, or, you know, those types of things. So if you don't know where those internal policies start because you're a smaller practice, they start with your compliance program.
You know, that's such a great point. And you know, a couple of weeks ago, I started talking about the OIG General Compliance Program Guidance, right? The GCPG is what they call it. And I've started disseminating that information. I did it with a post today, and I talked a little bit about the beneficiary inducements and the CMPs in a post this morning. But to your point, Christine, you raise a very good point. And the general compliance guidance that, you know, we're talking about actually has a section in there that talks about compliance policies and procedures. That's on pages 34 and 35 that talks about not only the creation of policies and procedures, but the maintenance of those policies and procedures. Don't ask me how I knew which page it was on, 34 and 35. It shows you how little life I have outside of health. All right. But no, that's a fantastic point. Irrespective of the size of your organization, you've got to have effective policies and procedures, period.
So we're Sean, the policy, right? A policy isn't that, well, we were told to do it that way. That's not a policy.
Yeah. So
I always wonder who told them that. And they're like, well, that's what we were told. I'm like, who told you that? And they can never come up with the name.
Yeah, I'll tell you that when I'm in a federal courtroom and arguments are being made, one of the arguments that is not being made is somebody told us to do it that way.
But you've heard that before, right?
Yeah.
You have heard that.
I hear it all the time.
Yeah, so do we. And that's whenever I find noncompliance, and actually I have a meeting today about somebody who's like, we kind of figured something out. And I'm like, okay, well, why are you doing it this way? Well, they told us. I'm like, who's they? And they're like, and they can't come up with a name, but there is a they out there that's telling everybody how to do things wrong.
If I could figure out who they is,
we'd all be very wealthy.
We would.
There'd be a lot of ketams filed against they.
I think it's important that we do, you know, it, share with our listeners that we are in the era of audit. And you said this earlier in the year, Sean, and my phone has been ringing off the hook over the last 6 weeks from COVID audits. So payers coming back and they're saying that things were done inappropriately during COVID. And I have a lot of providers going, but we didn't know. We didn't, we followed guidance and then it changed and we didn't know it changed. And we really needed to be having those compliance meetings, especially during that time. But even if you didn't, let's have a compliance meeting this week, next week. Let's start up and say, did we do it right? What are we looking at? What are, you know, what areas can we possibly mitigate by talking about it today, making sure our policies are in place today?
Yeah, that's a great point. And, you know, I have a very good friend of mine who's an incredible white collar defense attorney, criminal defense attorney. And he's and I'm not going to mention his name right now because he's in a trial. But, you know, the current trial that he's dealing with are services rendered during the public health emergency. And some of the arguments that were being raised are, look, this was the Wild West. You know, guidance was being published. It was being retracted. New guidance was being pushed out. Look how many times the commercial payers had to rescind something. Look at how many times the AMA had to rescind their document that went out. And what is so crazy, everybody knows how wackadoodle the healthcare industry was. And the judge in the case was like, yeah, no. We're not going to use that as an excuse.
Well,
so,
Sean, remember what you asked me this, I think this past week?
Yeah.
You said, can you send me something that gave me this information like right at the beginning of the pandemic? I'm like, sure. And it was four pages. And now that document is what, 312 or something? Yeah. I'm like, just so you know, this is just the first day.
It's insane. And, yeah. You know, I tell people all the time, as busy as I was this year, and, you know, a lot of folks may hear, oh, well, seven trials. Is that really a lot? That is an exorbitant amount, you know, to do in a year. It is a tremendous amount of legwork. It's time, energy, effort, what's left of my brain cells. But it is, I mean, we have, I think, 30 that are being looked at for 2024. It's incredible what's going on. All right. So that leads me to you, Terry, and your topic. Because, you know, I think this has been a problem since I've been in healthcare now for almost 30 years. I think at the end of this year, it's my 30th year doing this kind of work. And the problem never seems to go away. It always just seems to hang out there. So let's talk about that.
Well, so my topic today, and I was really happy and excited to see the roundtable panel because I've been dealing with this a lot in the last month, and I don't know what's going on in November and December, but people are getting crazy. So I get a lot of people that have been calling me. I know Christine and I have had a couple of conversations about this. So I've had providers calling in a panic saying, we just identified that we have been doing things wrong and I'm worried. Or my most recent one, and the guy called me, I shouldn't say the guy, the physician called me on last Sunday. And he basically said, oh, you answer. And right when he said that, I'm like, oh no, why did I answer? And he basically was like telling me about how a nurse practitioner told him that if he just asked patients, he runs an urgent care rural area. If he just asked patients, are you depressed or have you had a loss of appetite? He can go from a level 2 to a level 4. And I went, who told you that? He goes, well, I can't really tell you who it is, but I have a feeling I'm doing it wrong because he went on to tell me, I do a BS exam. I do this and I did everything she said. And we're actually making money now. He goes, I wasn't making money before, but really my stuff is really a level like straightforward. He goes, I don't even spend 5 minutes with them. And he's actually telling me this. We didn't even have an engagement. I'm like, wait, do you please don't stop talking. Don't talk to me. So I ended up referring him to one of our NSCHBC attorneys, but My point is, and here's my topic. What happens when a provider realizes that they've been billing inappropriately, they've been given some bad advice, they know they, you know, have done that. And here's what I get. I get, okay, so how do I move on from that, fix it, and then just from this point on, do it right? And I'm like, well, first of all, we've got to talk about a self-report. You know that you've been doing it incorrectly. You know that this is, you know, something that you shouldn't have kept this money. You shouldn't have received this money. They're like, oh, no, I can't afford a refund. I just want to go from this point on. So I've had this happen a lot, and it's really tough because want to put it back on you.
Is that really an option? I received money that doesn't belong to me, and I'm not supposed to have it, but I get to keep it.
They feel like, yeah, but you know what? Somebody else told me to do that, so I don't understand why I have to pay it back because I figured it out and, you know, my bad, and now I'm going to, you know, move past it, and I won't do it anymore. So I'm going to throw it to Scott because he's always my voice of reason. He's like that little Jiminy Cricket on my shoulder that has this language that just makes everything beautiful. Go ahead, Scott.
No, I'm just back from New Zealand, right? So I may fail today, but you know, I get the same question all the time. And the question I usually ask back is, you have money that you know you're not entitled to. It's not a question of maybe we are and maybe we aren't. You've made that decision. You know, sometimes you go through a process and you make a different decision, right? Like you may say, I feel like this is defendable. I tell this to clients all the time. You may be able to defend this, but let's figure out some language where you don't have to defend it, right? Where it is much better test of the scrutiny of the audit. And so when you've made that decision, we have money we're not entitled to, you have to pay it back, right? There's really no other way to look at it, right? I mean, this isn't like you got home from the supermarket and you were like, oh, you know, they only charged me for 5 yogurts and I have 6, right? Like Safeway isn't going to send like a battalion of like lawyers after you. Safeway is probably not going to indict you for that. But you're teetering on a razor's edge when you think about that. Now, I don't, you know, it's probably beyond my expertise in terms of saying I found these 3 errors. You know, I, as a compliance professional or as a practice manager, is not necessarily going to say, well, I therefore assume I have 900 errors sitting in here. But if you have decided, everybody, we all agree that this $38 we're not entitled to because it should have been a 99213 and we billed a 99214, you got to pay it back.
Yeah, and this is where a compliance program comes into place, because it really needs to lay out in detail a policy of what to do in those situations, particularly as it applies to corrective action going forward. But most importantly, how you're going to make a determination. And this is a really interesting case, Terry, because they were just saying, oh, I did a psych eval and I went from a 2 to a 4. How in the world do you track that without having billed one of those separate, depression screening codes, right? That says we collected this money? Do you do it by diagnosis code? Well, what if they didn't have depression? You know, I mean, it really becomes incumbent on the practice to say, this is our absolute best attempt to fix this. And yes, it is important to pay that money back because you have made a determination that you gamed it incorrectly.
He even went on to say, he said something to the effect that, well, he goes, you know, they're coming in for, you know, they tripped and fell and they have an ankle injury. And he goes, I don't really want to ask them about their depression. And I went, dude, stop talking right now because you're not helping yourself. But Sean, I have a question for you on this.
Yeah, go ahead.
Okay. And it's not how, cause we all know we basically say to them, look, if you know that you didn't do this, you've got 60 days to self-report from the moment you figured out that this is a problem. But I'm getting administrators and physicians alike, I don't want to pick just on physicians and providers, that are saying, we don't want to return the money, or we can't afford to return the money. Or my favorite one is, we're in a rural area, they're not going to come after us.
Yeah. So let me silo these for everybody. Because we have some distinctions that have to be made, right? So the first distinction is, could any of these found mistakes, right? identified and confirmed mistakes. Can any of these potentially rise to the level of fraud, waste, or abuse? Right? So under the False Claims Act, does an individual have actual knowledge that they have submitted a false claim? Or are they acting in deliberate ignorance or with reckless disregard, which is malicious intent, right? Because if you believe that someone can make a case, either the government through an independent UPIC investigation or an OIG desk audit or a MAC who escalates to a UPIC or a SMERC, if you believe that something could potentially rise to the level of fraud, waste, or abuse, you need to, one, get with an attorney who understands healthcare, okay? And consider what is referred to as an OIG self-disclosure protocol, because you want to make voluntary restitution. You want to get under the protection of the Office of Inspector General to avoid any administrative or legal proceedings that could come from that. Then second, the second silo is we did a chart audit. It was a random chart audit. It was not a statistically valid random sample. We had a, just going to pull a percentage. We had a 20% error rate. Should we expand that, right? Should we go further? My answer is if you have a 20% error rate, yeah. I don't want somebody coming to me and going, well, we get it right 80% of the time. I always respond by saying, would you go to a surgeon and allow them to cut you if they told you they get it right 80% of the time? Probably not. So if we have something where we determine that we need to expand it into a statistically valid random sample, and we find that we definitely have, based on the identification and the confirmation and overpayment, we can do a voluntary refund if we don't believe that any of this is going to rise to the level of fraud, waste, or abuse. I will tell you, I have had clients that have refunded in upwards of $400,000. And that's it. The government gets their money, they close the case, they move forward, and they go on as long as you make a bona fide disclosure, right? Full disclosure, full transparency. Whatever you want to refer to it as.
Sean, I have a question real quick before you move
sure.
on.
Sure.
And it's for you.
Yeah.
Because you may have seen this in your travels. I've had practices saying they don't want to do an audit because they don't want to find the problem.
Yeah, that's just one of the dumbest things you've
Well, you know, it reminds me, it's almost like the people, I have people in my family who are like, well, the way I won't find out I'm sick is I'll never go to the doctor, right?
Yeah. It's called living in denial. And then the third way that you can handle an overpayment is via a corrected claims process. With Medicare, they give you 12 months to do it, correct it. If you have an overage, you pay it back, whatever it may be. One last thing that I'll say is if you decide, Sean, I don't like any of the options that you've just given me, or Terry or Christine or Paul or Scott, or you guys don't know what you're talking about because someone told me to do it this way, that's fine. Just keep in mind that there's something in the False Claims Act referred to as a reverse false claim, which looks at a person's mindset at the time the claims were submitted. And again, I am giving you this information as someone who is spending 300 days a year working on federal, criminal, and civil matters. That's all I do these days. So again, please, listen to the guidance that we are giving to you, the recommendations on remaining compliant. And whoever said it a moment ago, probably I think it was Scott or Paul, you've got to have an effective policy on refunds, on audits. Scott, go ahead. I know you got something that you want to add.
Yeah. So one last thing about this, we go into practices all the time for various reasons, revenue cycle reviews, audits, and all of this. And the one thing I wanted to speak to is this mindset of, well, you know, we've learned our lesson and we don't have to return it. We won't do it again. You know, one of the things that I find we derive the most value of from going on site that sometimes gets lost in the remote process is, you know, you talk to people and you get a sense of how an organization operates. And the reason I say that is, you know, you may think, well, we have that mindset and that's what we're going to go forward with, but people in your organization are going to sing like canaries about all of these little details, you know. And so when Sean talks about mindset, right, like, you know, if for whatever unfortunate reason you do find yourself in the midst of a payer audit, if you had an internal process where you did a review and you found out you got overpaid on some charts and you said, well, we've learned our lesson, we won't do that again, like, if you don't think somebody in that building is going to bring that up at some point, you're very mistaken, right? And yeah. So it's going to come out.
Listen, the number of quitam cases that Paul and I are dealing with. Listen, I just had an attorney. Paul was on the email. I just had an attorney here in Atlanta send me an email at the end of last week saying, hey, are you able to accompany me early next week to the AUSA to help me make the case for why this quitam should be quashed, why they should go to the judge and request for the case to be dismissed? The AUSAs are all ears, especially, remember, a lot of times the AUSAs will turn down a case because there's a lack of resources, a lack of funding, a lack of manpower to be able to do it. They don't necessarily turn a case down because they think it's, you know, poop. They turn it down because they think, hey, let this other attorney do all the legwork for me. And if they wind up finding something that I believe is tangible, then the government will intervene. And now we'll ride in and save the day with all of our resources because now we have something. But Scott, I want to stay with you on this because I want to go to your topic, but I want to start by showing what Ginger said. And this ties perfectly, I think, into your topic, which is educating providers and staff. And, you know, Ginger talks about the fact that, you know, clients hire you to do an audit, but they don't like the results. So they want you to give them something different. To use her words, they try to get you to manipulate the project by excluding details from the report. Well, first thing that I will say is you should never hire an external consultant to do an audit unless it's being done under privilege. Any audit, no matter how superficial you think it is, no matter how innocuous, no matter how innocent you think the audit findings are going to be, you should always put it under attorney-client privilege so that an individual like Scott or Paul can say, or Terry or Christine can say, this audit was done at the direction of counsel. And then when the client goes back and says, well, I don't want it to say this, that, or the other, the attorneys can then figure out what is work product, what is privileged, what should and could be disclosed, what can't be disclosed, all those kind of things. But to take it on as a non-attorney where you don't have the benefit of work product doctrine or privilege, I tell consultants all the time, you have to be out of your mind to take on a project that could turn into a potential litigation or a self-disclosure without having proper guidance from an attorney. We don't do it in our company, at least in our division. I won't take on an audit for a client unless I know that I have access to general counsel or to external counsel. But Christine, I know you said you have a comment real quick, and then Scott, I want to go to you about education for audit results. Go ahead, Christine.
Well, I was going to just piggyback off what you were saying, Sean. A lot of practices will come back and say, you know, this is becoming very costly. Now I have a healthcare attorney that I have to engage to have you do the external audit to satisfy one of the requirements of maybe our compliance program or to get that baseline and see where we're at. And my answer to them is, you know, we have to bring in professionals into our business world. We bring in an accountant. I don't think any practice would think about doing their own taxes. They refer out to a CPA or they refer out to an accountant. This is just as serious. This is in the same line of that financial network. You need to have your healthcare attorney that you have associated with your practice, not just for attorney-client privilege work on an external audit, but God forbid you get an additional documentation request, or God forbid something escalates in your compliance program. And I have a compliance meeting this afternoon for some issues that I think we're going to have to refer to a healthcare attorney. But that's part of your team, your accountant, your healthcare attorney, your consultant. These are part of your normal process of business team.
Yeah, I
but Sean, do you know, just real quick,
go ahead,
Christine,
go ahead.
I know you want to get to Scott's. I have practices that think that auditing and doing and maintaining your practice for compliance and all that, they think consultants are a luxury item, not something that's a necessity. And so when they try to engage our services or anything, they're like, well, I don't really need to do that anymore. I just need to make sure I'm engaging with people who only find me revenue, who only know how to make me money, whether it's on above board or not. And so, and like Christine said, I have so many practices that I have ongoing audits. They have me auditing monthly, that they're on retainer, and we don't have an attorney a part of it. So, you know, I know I'm treading light waters there, but I have an attorney that I have on a retainer, and I let them know as part of my BAA, if I find inappropriate information or if I find a pattern, my attorney's going to come into this. And just so you know, I'm going to have you pay it back. And they have signed that they agree with that. So there is I don't want to say a backdoor attorney, but they won't do it under an attorney because they don't want the expense. You know, they're like, well, you're the enough of an expense. So just saying what Christine was saying, as far as, you know, trying to explain to them, the team, legal assistance is so expensive right now that they just don't want to engage in it, as far as what I'm seeing. But I do have a lot of practices that are like, well, if you're going to find stuff that's wrong, then I'm just going to go with people that find stuff that's right. And I'm like, well, I'm hoping I'm giving you peace of mind that a lot of it is right. And I hope I don't find anything that's wrong. But, and we're hoping there are some revenue opportunities maybe you're not seeing. But the bottom line is, we want to make sure that what you're documenting and what you're submitting to the payer is accurate, is above reproach, and isn't something that you're going to get flagged for or tagged for from an audit perspective. Because yeah, as we've all said,
Gary, I have a client right now that they're trying to sell their practice, and they can't because the due diligence audit came up with all of these problems. And I'm being brought in as part of the counsel who is now talking about an overpayment or voluntary disclosure, and they're dumbfounded. When did this happen? How did this get this bad? Now I can't even sell my practice. This provider is going to have to continue working the practice to pay back the massive overpayment.
Well, and then when they put out information, you know, AMA, they drive me crazy because they put out information like the prolonged services. And Sean, you and I have talked about this. And because a lot of the E&M services say, or because the E&M services, once you hit a level 5, then you can add the, you know, the codes on, whether it be Medicare G code, HCPCS, or the numeric category 1. But because they allow non-face to face, I'm continually getting that, well, it's technically correct, and I can add any non-face to face garbage that I want. And you see this manipulation of services. I'm like, but it has to be what you do personally, not what you hand a chart to one of your staff and say, schedule, coordination of care, do this. And yeah, exactly, Christine. I see, I'm like, have you looked at what your payer policies are telling you? Because just because the AMA puts this out and CPT book says, this is our recommendation, it's not legal, it's not law.
Let me speak to that for just a second.
I'm sorry.
No. But I think this is critical. So, you know, in the last case that I just came off of, and we got full not guilty verdicts. So 6 trials in a row, not guilty verdict for the Medicare fraud portions. One of the things that the prosecutor insisted on doing was, this is the CPT manual. This is the AMA, you know, book. This is what the providers code from. CMS says that they follow AMA guidelines. And I had to remind this prosecutor that book, using your own words, is nothing more than guidelines. Guidelines don't have the effect of law. LCDs, LCAs are sub-regulatory guidance documents. You cannot use something that does not have the effect of law to create law. You could talk to any constitutional scholar. You could talk to any attorney who has basic fundamental understanding of sub-regulatory guidance documents, and they will explain that to you. But, you know, here's the thing that I will tell you. If you call somebody like me in my department to do an audit for you, you have to understand that you are hiring me for risk mitigation purposes. You are hiring me to find problems or to either confirm or refute potential problems that were identified by the staff at your organization. If we happen to find missing revenue, well, that's a bonus. Congratulations. But my job is not to come in there as a revenue cycle, you know, Nostradamus to predict all of the areas where you have missed billing opportunities. That's not my job, because I don't go into court and go, well, that's not true. I actually do go into court sometimes and say, hey, wait a minute. You're accusing them of billing a level 3, but in actuality, they should have billed a level 4. Now, that we do make as a defense. But when I get hired, you're not hiring me to find revenue. You are hiring me to identify risks. You are hiring me to find problems before a government entity or a special investigative unit or a MAC determines that they want to take a look under the hood. All right. So, Scott, you've been really patient. I want to go back to what we were about 10 minutes ago before we all went on our rant. I want to talk about edumacation of providers.
So I sort of came on this almost by accident, you know, and it has to do with what we talk about when we educate and what the result of that is, because we may think we're explaining something and the provider may hear it differently. And I'll give you an example. So I was working with an oncologist, and we've been working together for quite a bit. And one of the things, when we first started working together under the 2021 guidelines, we were walking through the distinction between a level 3 and a level 4. And in my telling of it, the service was a clear level 3 as documented. And I felt like the medical necessity supported that. And the provider was talking about orders and different things like that. So, you know, I felt like we came to a good place. And so we were going to go back and re-review in a few months. And one of the things that this provider had done, typically, to give you an example on the prostate cases, when he's doing the surveillance, he's ordering a PSA and a total testosterone. Patient's coming back, at whatever frequency the patient's coming back. So lo and behold, when we get back to doing the next round of audits, all these patients are now getting a CBC, a CMP, a total testosterone, and a PSA. And so when I walk through the guidelines, now I'm at a level 4, right? Like, it hasn't changed my view of the necessity of the case. And it really made me be very thoughtful about what I'm explaining and what the provider's hearing. And, you know, the reason I think this is important is as health systems get bigger, one of the bigger things I tend to see with internal audit processes is the guidelines have almost become like the 11th commandment, right? Like, it's the easiest way to train people to a specific outcome, whether it's the doctors, the billers, the auditors, the compliance, is just to say, take this thing and hold it right up close to your chest and never deviate from it. But what if you have a client or you have a provider, and you know, I have a few of these, right? And they order labs like it's almost like a package with a car, right? Like, it's like the floor mats and the undercoating, and everybody gets it. So, you know, a provider will order COVID-19, flu AB, rapid sore throat, and sore throat culture. A lot of labs. And then they're going to give the patient a prescription, either to help them sleep or something to try to mitigate the symptoms. But the patient essentially has like a URI. And in a lot of these cases, the patient does not have any positive findings related to the throat at all, right? Like, the throat in the exam is negative. So, but it's just, it's the package, right? And everybody gets it, you know? And so having those conversations about, well, okay, why are you ordering a sore throat rapid and a sore throat culture on a patient who does not report any symptoms of a sore throat? And, you know, the reality is most of audits that are done, the audit, certainly I'm not a clinician, and most audits that are being done are non-clinical. But when you find yourself in a real serious situation, they're going to call a doctor in and the doctor's going to start to make determinations. Why did you order these things for these patients? And so for me, you know, guidelines are just guidelines, right? The guidelines change, the documentation changes. Medical necessity is the anchor by which we operate the practice. And so for me, like, medical necessity is the proxy for my way of trying to say, well, this patient has, you know, the sniffles and maybe a light headache, and you've ordered, you know, all these labs, but your colleague down the hall didn't order them. You've coded the cases differently. One case by the guidelines is a 3. One case by the strictest interpretations of the guidelines is a 4, but it's the same person. And so I think there's a real question there about making sure the education of a provider is centered on educating around the medical necessity of a case, how that aligns with the coding selection, how the provider uses a phrase like chronic. I mean, I've had a provider diagnose a chronic cough for a patient who the history says has been coughing for 3 days, has no additional detail to suggest that the cough is chronic, right? And so it's about the correlation or the link up between good documentation with a history that gives you a full and complete overview of the case and how that ties into the coding. Because it's not necessarily me saying this can never be a 4, but it's really about how the documentation ties into the necessity of the result and making sure that we don't get caught up in saying, well, if I order X number of these, if I write a prescription, that's the path to a 4. Because I have a lot of clients come up to me and they will say, well, this has to be a 4 because we did 3 orders and we wrote a prescription, but the patient's case isn't particularly serious. And I think the reason I get concerned about it is I think sometimes we come to that fork in the road and we say, well, we have some providers who do it this way and they bill a 3, and some providers do it this way and they bill a 4. Why don't we just tell everybody to build a higher level service? And I'd read a story recently, and this will be my last thought on this. It may have been the New Yorker, and I wish I could remember, but I can find it out. But it had to do with some physicians in Minnesota who are actually unionizing. And it's not mostly about that. The story was about the physicians feel like they're being told to do things for reimbursement purposes that misalign with what they believe is the clinical focus of the case. And so the added risk to that is, you know, for me as an external auditor, when I tell a physician to do something, I'm essentially handing them a bag of risk, right? And I'm saying, like, this is what you're doing if I'm telling them to use these things to drive their coding to higher levels. And so, you know, hopefully I explained that well, but I think there ought to be a real focus in our education on the correlation of medical necessity specifically to how the provider views the severity of the case. Because when I say I think something might be a 4 that the provider says is a 3, I don't just say, well, you're wrong. The provider's the one that managed the patient. So I'm trying to dive in and figure out, like, is there some misalignment between how I'm reading the note versus how they're reading the note? And I think that's important, because I find sometimes that I'm having conversations with internal compliance people, internal auditors, internal coders, who are conferring risk to the provider by their actions or by the things that they're training to, that potentially are going to reverb on the whole organization, because a guideline is really just a guideline and you can't just order your way up, right? It's not Burger King. You can't just throw some extra stuff in there. And I think it's important to be thoughtful about that.
Yeah. You know, and that's such a great explanation of it. I think one of the things that people need to get a grasp on is that the reason we're in the situation we're in with services like evaluation and management services is because there's no universal standard. There's no universal requirement, right? It's highly subjective. Keep in mind, we got away from the early years of UCR, usual, customary, and reasonable, where a provider saw a patient and they put down on a sheet of paper what they did. It was brief, intermediate, or high, and they got reimbursed on that. And we went to a quantification system, meaning a bean counting system with the 1995 guidelines. And then you ticked off a whole bunch of specialists who were like, well, hey, what about us? You know, we don't do this part of an examination. So then you got the 97 guidelines. And then they became so problematic because they are so subjective, right? I mean, one provider, to Scott's point, is going to do something and they're going to consider that to be straightforward or low complexity, while other providers are going to be doing it and considering it to be moderate complexity. So what did the government do? We're done. We're going to put patients over paperwork, and we're going to do an administrative simplification, and we're going to make it so much easier for you, but we're going to make it even more subjective because we're going to base your reimbursement now for your level of service solely on medical decision-making. I mean, this is the problem that we have. We have no universal regulation. We have guidelines. And the guidelines are open to interpretation. Guidelines are like buttholes. Everybody has one. So, Terry, I know you have a thought on this. Go ahead.
I do. So I had something recently come up, actually, Saturday, why do I even answer the phone or check email on the weekends? I don't understand what's wrong with me because it's not working out. It's usually where all the problems happen. But I had a client contact me and say, you know, I just need the updated guidance for telehealth because, you know, I'm so submerged in that. And they said, because we're, you know, we're a pediatric practice and we're seeing patients where the patient isn't necessarily on the encounter. It's just the parents. And I went, oh, no, what? And they said, yeah, the patient's not really there, but that's okay because the CPT book says, you know, discussion with patient and her family. I'm like, have you seen the CPT guidance since 2021? And she's like, what are you talking about? I'm like, let's just open our books together. Let's do this together. So, you know, and I opened the 2023 book. I said, let's just pick out one at random, 99203. It says office or other outpatient visit for the evaluation management of a new patient, which requires medically appropriate history and or examination, low-level medical decision-making, excuse me, and then it talks about time. Nothing does it say about patient and or family anymore. They took that language out. And so people, I know that we got a lot of updates and people highlighted some of the things that they were, you know, interested in, but nobody talked about that. It's not now patient or family anymore. It's patient. It's patient-centered care. And, you know, I quote Christine daily in my life because, and I think I quote Scott and Paul and Sean too. I think I do, all of you. But the one thing that has really been an issue is the fact that common sense doesn't seem to be part of what's going on in following guidelines. And I'm not trying to be flip. I'm not trying to be mean. I'm just saying that if you haven't updated yourself, you haven't read the new guidelines, you haven't looked at the language. And yes, this is, it's a reference guide, the CPT book, but the reference that every payer uses, you still have to refer to where you're making your policies from. And if you're saying that you're going to see patients, you know, parents without the patient actually, you know, at least in the mother's arms or sitting in the crib where you turn it over and go, they're right there. You know, you're going to have a problem. And I know pediatric practice is a little different. But to use old language, to use, you know, retired policies and not updating yourself. I've heard Sean say a lot of time, deliberate ignorance. It's not a default. You're not going to be able to prove that, well, I didn't know. And so, Paul, you first, and then I know Christine wants to jump in. So, Paul, your comments.
Well, I don't quote anybody on this podcast. Being a musician, I usually quote songwriters, and I'll take Lou Reed for this one. There's a bit of magic in everything, and then some loss to even things out. And if you think it's ugly now, just, and I'm ticketing this mainly because I'm doing a session on this at the annual NAMIS conference in Charleston, South Carolina in a few days. If you think it's bad now, wait until AI gets involved, because we already have enterprising physicians out there saying, build me documentation for a level 4 E&M service with these diagnoses. and they really think it's going to pass muster.
I just asked a CMS. I said, I audit for Medicare payers. And I said, hey, you're saying that they can get time included for their documentation. I said, well, what about when they're using AI? Like, well, we haven't really thought that far yet. And they said, no doctors are going to use AI and use time to their code. I'm like, what planet are you on? Of course and they're going to try it.
Then the patient's going to read the AI generated note and be like, when did I get leprosy?
I know.
The other problem that you have with AI is that if you actually pay attention to it, it will cite cases and it will cite different things. And when you look at them, they're completely miscited. And I'll tell you, LinkedIn is actually kind of funny right now because you can, on a post, you can click use AI, and just for kicks and giggles, I like my post I did this morning, that had the bullet points and stuff like that. When I clicked AI, it showed the three bars running across the screen, and it took what I did and it shortened it to less than three sentences, and it took keywords and it hashtagged them. But when I read it, it took out the actual purpose of what I was creating. So I hit undo and I sent it out. And I've been doing that with all my posts just to see what kind of stuff LinkedIn's AI is posting.
AI hallucinates. You can start to write ruptured, Achilles, and it'll put in ruptured appendix. It puts in what it learned the last. And yeah. So, and doctors are like, well, we'll review the note. I'm like, you will? Well, like, you review the notes now?
Yeah, let me go to Christine real quick, and I'll come to you, Scott, real quick. Go ahead, Christine.
I know that we're wrapping up.
Go ahead.
No, but I wanted to leave some words of wisdom. Very important. Two education sessions that every practice needs to have every year. One being an update to compliance. There's something about repetition. There's something about the new policies that you do in your organization that need to be shared with your staff members, with your people, boots on the ground. But second and most important are your updates for the upcoming year. So like Terry is saying, there should never be a surprise that this changed or it changed, the terminology in it. You should be attending one update every year. Search for it. Have your compliance team put it together. Maybe it's just on the procedure codes or the diagnosis codes that you provide in your office, but you need to have that update education. It's imperative.
Absolutely. All right, Scott, go for it.
I've been on vacation the last couple of weeks, and the only reason I bring that up is because I read a lot on vacation. And so the thing that I read that was interesting to me about AI was, that as people, we use these like neural networks and we build on our own experiences, and that's how we learn and how we decide different things. And with AI, the more data you put in, it's just trying to parse through all the different things to act as though it were a person. And so when Sean talks about, legal citations that are wrong, or I joke about, a patient ending up with leprosy, it's only because AI is taking the aggregate data that's putting in and try to think through it to get to a result. Like AI may say, well, I have data that suggests a 99214 is three labs, so I'll just put three labs in, and those labs may not necessarily tie into whatever's going on with the patient's condition. And in that way, AI wouldn't necessarily make those distinctions. The last thing I would say, again, specifically to the guidelines, I was trying to find it while Christine was talking, but one of the things pretty sure I gleaned through the AMA slides from the annual update was that they were basically saying that parenteral controlled substances were no longer, quote, or they were clarifying that it was not automatically high risk based on the provider's prescription, but was really more about the discussion of the thought process, which I think, in terms of at least baby steps towards the way we try to view charts and think about the risk associated with provider actions, it's beneficial, but again, is another reason to make sure that we're on top of those annual updates.
Yeah. All right. Well, for our second to last Monday Coding and Compliance Roundtable for 2023, I think it was an excellent discussion. I want to thank Christine, Paul, Terry, Scott, Christine, I know you struggled with some technology issues at the beginning, but you made it on, and I'm grateful for you being here and your contributions. And to all of you who are tuning in, logging on, and hanging out with us each and every single Monday, thank you all so much for doing that. We really appreciate it. We hope that you find these sessions and these discussions, these collaborations that we do every Monday to be a benefit to you. And we will continue to do those. We have a lot of great stuff, I'm sure, coming down the pike in 2024 with some of the final rule changes, some of the things that are going on. Obviously, we're always looking for topics that are plaguing you all as compliance professionals, as certified coders, billers, healthcare professionals. Reach out to us, DM us, post something, and tag us in one of your posts, and I think you'll find we're all pretty responsive to those things. All right, so tomorrow, Terry and I will be back for our second to last hashtag Terry Tuesday for 2023. I'm looking forward to that one. We're going to be talking about the G2211. I have my own thoughts. I'm sure Terry has hers. It should be a lively discussion as it normally is. So until then, remember, be good to yourself, but more importantly, y'all be good to each other. Take care.
You've been listening to The Compliance Guy. Sean has been doing this for 28 years. He holds 10 national board certifications. He's a partner and the vice president of compliance for Doctors Management, LLC. He's a subject matter expert in federal court. He's lectured at the most prestigious institutions. He's engaged with members of Congress in both chambers. So what we're saying is he's qualified? We hope you've enjoyed the show. Make sure to like, rate, and review. And we'll be back soon. But in the meantime, you can find us on social media at The Compliance Guy. See you next time on The Compliance Guy.